are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, December 11th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, on the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. Also on the program today, the Department of Justice Inspector General testifies no political bias in the FBI's launching of an investigation into the Trump campaign. However, there were subsequent FISA applications against Carter Page, in which people lied, more or less, in those applications. Meanwhile, Bill Barr still harping on a deep state conspiracy. That ship drifted a little further from the shore today. Donald Trump targets protests against Israel with an executive order redefining anti-Semitism and using a definition written by a guy who specifically says it should not be used in this way. Meanwhile, Pete Buttigieg dodging his role in some major Blue Cross layoffs. Joe Biden is now privately admitting he thinks he can only last one term as president. Trump pays $2 million for misusing charity funds. I just use them differently than for charity. It starts at home, folks. Federal judge blocks Trump's misappropriation of funds for his border wall. Lastly, internal emails reveal that the water contractor in Flint, Michigan, knew about the Flint lead poisoning months before the city confirmed it. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. A lot going on. We've been following the Inspector General Department of Justice Inspector General testimony today in the Senate. And the gist of it, and we'll play some clips from it. It's important because, you know, we want to ruin QAnon's day, I guess. But the gist of it is that after this thorough investigation, the inspector general found that the launching of the investigation into the Trump organization or the Trump campaign was completely justified. That during the course of the campaign, the one person that they were surveilling, this was Carter Page, and they had been surveilling him apparently off and on since 2013. In the third or fourth renewal of the FISA applications, a FBI lawyer essentially doctored some piece of evidence. It wasn't necessarily the make or break in terms of continuing to surveil Carter Page, but it was highly inappropriate, probably illegal, it seems to me. But I don't know if they're pressing charges against this guy. I think they have referred it to an investigation. But that was on Carter Page, who was apparently in the course of this investigation, this counterintelligence investigation against Trump, sort of a sidebar. The real story was, of course, that George Papadopoulos had basically told as far as we know, an Australian diplomat, we're anticipating getting stuff from Russia that's going to help the campaign. But we will play clips from that. The relevance of this is limited, I hope that it leads to some type of FISA reform. I think that we have apparently some in the wake of Edward Snowden, but clearly there's some gaps in this process. There does not seem to be anybody who really investigates the applications to FISA. They're just basically rubber stamped. Now, this is something that, you know, we've known since the late aughts, as it were, at least, you know, that I've been talking about it and was aware of it at that time. Hopefully we'll get some reform out of this. Highly doubtful. But as far as Lisa Page and Peter Strzok, they may have to be replaced in the narrative, although Bill Barr is still out there trying to figure it out. In the meantime, we're going to talk to Lori Wallach today on this USMCA. It's an interesting sort of debate where it really is all sort of speculative. I was on Chris Hayes' program last night arguing with Barbara Boxer about whether this was a good thing to do. We will hear at least what happened as far as the agreement. You can make a determination as to whether it is worth it. And I think we end the conversation with Lori Wallach. I pre-taped this earlier with the, you know, well, I guess we'll know, you know, sometime late in November of 2020. But as I was going into the makeup room to take the makeup off my face, and when I told Saul I did that, he was pretty shocked that I put makeup on. He didn't realize. He had watched the show last night, I guess. He wouldn't go to bed. And I came in, and I have to go through a door. They don't give me a full pass because I am such a barely employee there that I get a knock on the one of the locked doors, and there was a bunch of, like, you know, guys with no necks, older guys, look like security guys. You can see. They all look the same, with all due respect to those guys. And I'm like, I wonder what this is about. You see that occasionally because there's like a congressperson or a senator or something like that. And I go in, I grab I know where it is. I've been in this place a million times. I grab my washcloth thing and I look over, sitting in the chair right next to me is Mayor Pete Buttigieg. And now, here's the thing. My buddy from high school, Joe O'Brien, became mayor of Worcester, which is twice the size of the city that he was in. So
you should have said that.
I'm not that impressed that I'm standing next to a mayor.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've met college town mayors too.
Sam. Exactly. In fact, I was student government president at my small liberal arts college and got almost as many votes for that position as he did as mayor. So I wasn't that impressed. But I got to say that generally when I meet people, like, there's two type of politicians I will speak to. Ones who I really like and ones who I think are totally evil. He is not quite achieved that level yet because, I don't know. He hasn't had the chance, the opportunity in my mind to really influence politics in that way.
He's evil. Look at his McKinsey consulting.
Yeah,
you haven't, that alone.
It's possible.
You haven't tried to buy a loaf of bread in Canada yet.
Yeah, you think he's evil. Also, but you would debate one, potentially on MSNBC, like a Barbara Boxer.
Oh, well, I mean,
I'm just putting it out there for the memeologists in the audience. Rob Reiner style romantic comedy vehicle
between Barbara Boxer and I. Well, yes, that starts by arguing about sort of like
the new NAFTA on MSNBC. I think it writes itself.
What was it? What was that mod? And what was that? I can't remember what that. There was a
Harry Met Sally.
No, there was a different one.
Harold and Maude. You're suggesting that you're that much younger than she is.
I don't know. It's getting pretty close.
Wow. Now we're really escalating for the next appearance. I like it.
It's not totally Harold and
Maude. I suggested that there was a Harold and Maude Senator Boxer.
I figured the best thing for me to do is just looked at him like this, and he's sitting in the chair, and he's like this, and I'm like, And I didn't even acknowledge him. I figure, like, a guy like that, the best thing to do is just, I don't recognize who this dude is. Big deal.
We're probably in a spreadsheet that he has somewhere.
I would imagine. I mean, you know, like, there's been times in MSNBC where I've gotten into arguments with, like, Pataki. Yeah, I don't know if you were around when he said to me, like, you're not that stupid that you actually believe that. Stuff like that.
And, Pataki.
Yeah, exactly. But so here's Pete Buttigieg after he get out of the makeup chair. And I think I heard him say, make me look older. And I'm joking. And he went on, and there is apparently, as you know, there is footage of him talking about one of his consulting gigs where he found a lot of redundancy, had to lay off a bunch of people. And Wendell Potter.
It's a very weird way of talking about burning down an Afghan village.
Right. Well, no, Wendell Potter, a former insurance executive, had said at the time, like, I'm pretty sure what he's talking about is, like, you know, a Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Yeah, he totally called it.
Totally called it. And so Buttigieg, who worked for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. Now, understand, the amount of money that's involved with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan is the CEOs get a lot of money. Here he is being asked about it, and then Rachel Maddow responds.
When you did that sort of cost and overhead assessment for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, a couple of years after that, they laid off like 1,000 people. Was your work part of what led to those layoffs?
I doubt it. I don't know what happened in the time after I left. That was in 2007 when they decided to shrink in 2009. Mm-hmm. Now, what I do know is that there are some voices in the Democratic primary right now who are calling policy that would eliminate the job of every single American working at every single insurance company in the country.
Do we have more footage there? We don't. Does she respond like, oh, no, that's a total lie? So, in other words, he dodges his recommendations to cut, and the idea that, like, I have no idea what happened. As a consultant, what happens is I give the recommendations and then they do it the next day, I guess.
What's the Bible verse for having humility about your contribution to mass layoffs when you're a consultant?
But I hope that the next thing that Rachel says here is, well, that's a complete lie. In fact, everyone knows that all those people at Blue Cross Blue Shield, a significant percentage of them, probably a majority of those people who are working, not the CEOs necessarily, because they may not find it as lucrative, but they will be contracted in the same way that, they will either be contracted to do certain things for Medicare for All, or they will be hired because they are qualified to come in and do much of the same work.
I just would like to add that word he uses of when they decided to shrink, I think it was the word he used. Was that the word he used? Maybe they shrunk. They did some shrinking after I was
shrinkage.
There. Shrinkage. That is such a tell, because people learn different euphemisms in different professions. Right. Talking about firing people, talking about laying off thousands.
Right, you don't
people.
Say layoffs. You don't say shrinkage.
You say a shrink. Right. I mean, you could. This is all. It's all George Clooney up in the air stuff. Look at the euphemism.
I tried finding it, but that's where Maddow clips it on her.
Yes. Site, so. Well, I mean, the response for Rachel, hopefully, was Pete on or Mayor Pete. Honestly, that's a little disingenuous. The idea that all those people are going to lose a job. And in fact, it's outlined in every person's plan who's come out with a Medicare for All plan speaks to what will happen to hundreds of thousands of those people. Will go back in and either work for the government plan or end up being contracted out to do parts of the government plan. It's just absurd. Meantime, folks, if you feel like you don't have time to read all the books you want to, welcome to the club. Welcome to Sam's I Don't Have Time to Read All of the Books I Want To club.
Blinkist is an app that compiles the key takeaways from thousands of nonfiction books. Everything you need to know is condensed down to 15 minutes. You can either read it or you can listen to it on the app. Blinkist is super unique. It works on your phone, it works on your tablet or your web browser. You'll find everything from self-help titles to history titles to science to economics to communication skills. Oh, wait a second. I know. You want to talk to McKinsey Pete? Go into the corporate culture section. You can learn about scaling up excellence or how successful people think, or meetings suck too fast to think. I mean, there's a whole mess of these books, and I've talked about like the sort of sex and relationships. Oh, they have that Christopher Ryan book that you like so much, Sex at Dawn. You can listen to it 15 minutes. Emotional Intelligence.
That's a book I like.
That's one maybe I will look into, all things
I've
considered.
I've been recommending it to you for years. I know. You never listen.
Well, but with Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. All the books you want for one low price. So you don't have to stop improving yourself. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for our listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/majority. Try it for free for 7 days. And then when you realize, like, I got to get this, you save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/majority to start your 7-day free trial and then get 25% off. Check it out, folks. Don't forget, like my favorite, the 4-Hour Work Week, Tim Ferriss. That's the one. That's my aspiration. That's my aspiration for everybody. Well, yeah, not everybody. I don't have to aspire for some. Some have already.
Oh, if only it were so. You know, the joke just doesn't work anymore.
I don't know. I think people think it's funny. Matt laughed. Folks!
Well, he did. Your redundancy is charming.
Part of the contract.
Look, you already eat clean, right? I would imagine most of the people who listen to this show are trying to eat food that is healthy. Hopefully, if you're smart, you're using cleaning products at home that are not so toxic. Why would you put on makeup and skincare products that contain questionable ingredients? Beauty Counter is on a mission to get safer makeup and skincare products into everybody's hands. It started in 2013 when apparently they started to shed light, Beauty Counter did, on the need for stronger ingredient regulations. People don't realize there's none. As far as I know, there's virtually none. Today, it is the leading cleaning beauty brand, creates innovative and high-performing products that are safer and cleaner than competitors. They got everything that you'd need: moisturizers, makeup cleansers, sunscreen. Why are cleaner ingredients important? The U.S. hasn't passed a major federal law to regulate the ingredients used in personal care products since 1938. Over 1,500 questionable ingredients are never used in Beauty Counter's formulations. That's their clean promise. Kelly has been using Beauty Counter, and she says, I love having simple skincare, makeup routine. I've tried a lot of different things. And when shopping for cleansers, serums, creams, makeup, it's just easier to ignore the mind-boggling list of ingredients inside the packaging. Things like formaldehyde or coal tar. At one point, she realized that she didn't want any more benzocolonium chloride on her face. She says Beauty Counter makes it easy to avoid these ridiculous ingredients while still providing luxury products. I've been using Lotus Glow Cleansing Balm as a combination makeup remover and cleanser, which is a time saver. I don't understand whatever that means, but it sounds good. She writes, the overnight resurfacing peel brightens my skin with zero irritation, which is something close to miraculous. Not only is Beauty Counter committed to advancing clean skincare, everything I've used has required a fraction of the amount of product I'm used to, which makes their entire line a bargain. I'm a total convert. Beauty Counter has truly become my one-stop shop for all my skincare products and makeup. She actually like won't stop talking about it to me. Every time we have one, she writes like, I love this stuff. I'm like, okay, I get it. If you're new to Beauty Counter, now is the time to head to beautycounter.com. Check out special holiday offers before they're gone. That's beautycounter.com. You don't need a promo code. Just clean makeup, skincare, and gifts for everyone you love. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'll be talking to Lori Wallach about the USMCA. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, Lori Wallach. Lori, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
So yesterday, it was announced, and I think it, I don't know if we haven't had quite a, obviously it has to go to the Senate, but, and I don't know that they actually had the vote yesterday in the House, but it appears at the very least they have the votes, to pass the USMCA. This is the United States, Mexico, Canada agreement. It's NAFTA 2.0, I guess, maybe some would argue 1.2 or something like that. But that's why I wanted you here, Lori. Go through, just tell us a little bit of the background of what this supposed new NAFTA is. There's a lot of questions around this, not the least of which is, was it worth it doing this from a political standpoint? But let's first just look at the trade agreement itself.
So what happened yesterday was the Democrats announced that after a year of fighting to improve a really bad NAFTA renegotiation Trump signed in 2018, they had forced changes to the deal and the administration had agreed and Mexico and Canada had agreed. So there hasn't been a vote yet. The backstory of this is that after 25 years, NAFTA had proved to be the disaster that a lot of congressional Democrats and unions and consumer and environmental groups had predicted in the first instance. Over a million U.S. jobs are government certified as lost to NAFTA. $400 million had been paid out in investor state corporate attacks on North American environmental and health laws in front of tribunals of three trade officials. And the damage was ongoing. Every week, companies were outsourcing jobs to Mexico to pay workers less. Wages in Mexico are now lower than when NAFTA started and 40% lower than Chinese manufacturing wages. So the NAFTA was a mess and an ongoing mess with new damage happening every week. So the mission was, could changes be made to ameliorate that damage? And the deal that Trump renegotiated and declared was wonderful and gave a new name, he called it the USMCA, as you said, did that at the end of last year. That agreement actually was worse than the original NAFTA, in that Trump let pharma rig it and add new monopoly protections that would have locked in high medicine prices here, handcuffing Congress from changing the existing laws that have given us the highest medicine prices in the world, and then exporting those bad policies to raise prices in Mexico and Canada. So Democrats said, hey, your new NAFTA locks in high medicine prices and doesn't fix the original sin of NAFTA outsourcing. Forget about it. You got to renegotiate your renegotiated deal, or we're not interested. And then a year of fighting started. And yesterday, Trump agreed to a bunch of the Democrats' demands.
Let's talk about what those demands were. I mean, I know that at the very least, my understanding is that the investor dispute settlement, ISDS, you'll have to help me on this, but the mechanism in which essentially disputes are settled, that element seems to have been taken out. Is that correct?
So just yes. So to give a little background for your listeners, folks will remember when you guys were talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, and helping people understand what that was. This is those corporate tribunals at the heart of TPP. They came out of NAFTA. That was the model. And this is where multinational corporations can demand unlimited compensation from taxpayers by going to tribunals of three corporate attorneys who can decide if the investors' special rights and privileges given in the agreement were undermined by a domestic environmental or health or safety law. And under NAFTA, $400 million has been paid out by taxpayers to multinational corporations in successful attacks on energy regulations, water use policies, timber policies, toxic ban. Outrageous. So the new NAFTA.
And let me just add one more aspect of that. My understanding, too, that is also problematic is that it probably it's cost taxpayers in that because we've had to pay for profits that corporations would have anticipated getting were it not for laws that we made to protect the environment, to protect consumers, to protect workers or whatever it was. But also, I imagine we have instances where municipalities or counties or states or the country at large made decisions not to pass certain protections because of a fear of running afoul of that.
Precisely right. And also in some instances, existing protections were eliminated to avoid the next case after the first payout happened. So for instance, Canada got rid of a ban on a toxic gasoline additive we ban here after the Ethyl Corporation, the folks who put lead in our gasoline, won an ISDS NAFTA case, and part of the settlement was reversing that ban. So you're spot on. It's okay. A very bad thing. So what happened, what from my perspective, the single best thing in the new NAFTA is investor state dispute settlement was altogether eliminated between the U.S. and Canada. That's a big deal because most of the environmental ISDS NAFTA attacks have been U.S. corporations attacking Canada. And in fact, all of them but two have been that. And the elimination of ISDS between the U.S. and Canada also means 93%, almost all U.S. ISDS exposure is gone because of all the foreign investors in the U.S., only mainly the Canadian ones had ISDS rights. There are a handful of companies from other countries where we have free trade agreements that have ISDS, but mainly it was Canadian companies. So that is a huge improvement. Then with respect to Mexico,
and we should also say that the benefit of this is that maybe it provides a precedent for future trade deals saying we didn't have it here, we don't need it there.
Well, what I'm about to say is then with respect to Mexico, so people will say, okay, between two developed countries with strong court systems, I guess, maybe, whatever. But this is the thing that is truly precedent setting. With respect to Mexico, a country that doesn't have a strong rule of law, the new agreement whacks the old ISDS system, and it only allows compensation through a reformed process where, for instance, the tribunalist can't be both serving as a lawyer suing a government and serving as a judge. You have to pick a side. Or where the damages aren't based on the speculative future expected profits, which, as you pointed out, is what the current system is, but rather you have to prove actual damages. But also, the only thing you can get compensation for is if the government actually expropriates your property, takes it physically. A definition is physical seizure or total control of title. And for direct acts of discrimination against a foreign investor after your investment's been set up. That is compared to the current NAFTA, which creates this broad right for a foreign company to invest, right to control natural resources, right to not be regulated. All that stuff got whacked. So for the world to see, here in the belly of the beast, the country that had pushed ISDS, that expanded it. We are the country that expanded ISDS and the TPP to even more broader rights. Here we are getting rid of it altogether for developing countries. And with respect to with developed countries, and with respect to a developing country partner, basically narrowing it down to compensation for direct expropriation in a much more fair system. Okay. That is a huge signal to the whole world that even here, we see the ISDS system as illegitimate. And that's super helpful because a lot of developing countries started with South Africa. Brazil was out there already. Ecuador, Bolivia, Indonesia, other countries have said, we're out of this system. This thing is ridiculous. And now the U.S. basically sending the signal, lets a lot of other smaller developing countries join the bandwagon and try and exit this dangerous system. So that's the best thing in the New Deal. But even though the Democrats were able to get all that new bad pharma stuff out, and that's, you know, that's definitely worth noting, because typically U.S. trade agreements just keep giving the pharmaceutical companies more and more protections. That was just taking out a new bad thing. You know, that's like classic Trump, right? He creates a crisis and then he tries to get credit for fixing it. So that was like, you know, that was a bag of crap he put into it. And then, you know, okay, I'll take my bag of crap back out. But that was just an additional problem to the original NAFTA. The real open standing question is, are the improved labor and environmental standards that, you know, the original ones that Trump signed in his deal in 2018 were a mess. The Democrats made improvements for sure. But are those improvements, and is the improved enforcement going to actually prove to be enough to reverse some of the outrageous wage suppression in Mexico? Now, when Trump says this is going to bring back hundreds of thousands of jobs, that's 100% baloney, garbage, absurd. That's not happening. That's not what this deal is. This is not a transformational people and planet first, this is for the workers deal. The question is, can these improvements actually create real unions in Mexico so people can fight for real wages, and the result will be less draw to outsource jobs because folks in Mexico get paid more. That's the real story of what we have to watch to see if this deal does.
Okay. So we have the IMF saying that the most we can imagine is about 50,000 jobs tops created in the U.S. The question is do these reforms in terms of protections for labor in Mexico, do they have enough teeth? Will they be enforced in such a way that over time it will gradually increase the protections of and the wages of Mexican workers, which will then stabilize, you know, that sort of giant sucking sound that Ross Perot had talked about, I guess, gosh, 30 years ago now. All right. So with all that said, and my understanding, too, is that there were some financial sector giveaways as well, or at least protections for financial interests. What can you tell us about that before we sort of step back and make a sort of broad assessment?
Yeah. So what I can say generally is there's plenty of the bad stuff that was in the original NAFTA that didn't get fixed. And that includes all kinds of limits on regulation for food safety, for all kinds of services, energy, financial services. There is one new bad thing for financial services, which is the right to transfer data freely, financial data, which there was an exception in the original NAFTA, so that's slightly worse. But frankly, it was already really bad. It's just slightly worse. And some of this bad stuff was left intact, but it's already there. I mean, the thing everyone needs to understand is the agreement on offer is not the template for a good progressive agreement. A good progressive agreement would have climate provisions, which this doesn't. It would have enforceable currency disciplines. It would have rules against monopoly. It would not have any constraints on the regulation of food safety or the environment or the big online giants or some service sector like energy or finance. That stuff is leftover garbage from NAFTA, and it's, you know, still there. They didn't put in the things missing. They didn't take out some of the bad stuff.
So
what we have here is a floor with no ISDS. You know, it's mainly WAC. There's still some bits of it. It's a problem. But with ISDS, mainly WAC, without the crazy pharma stuff, with stronger labor and environmental standards and enforcement, maybe not strong enough to make a difference. We'll have to see if it works. That's the floor from which we'll have to keep advocating for a stronger, better, real progressive agreement. But the mission is to try and stop some of NAFTA's ongoing damage. And sort of the political quandary, which I know is where you're going,
right,
is who makes that call? As much as we all despise Trump, if there is on offer the prospect of actually making a lot of people in the U.S. and Mexico's lives better, then what is that line where not wanting to do it during the Trump era means we should deny the prospect of having an agreement that's better than the old one go into effect.
Correct.
And that is, from my take, when the ISDS whacking happened, is when I started saying to myself, all right, now I need to see if they get the pharma garbage out and if they make real progress in environment and labor and enforcement, because then we do have something that actually practically could make people's lives better and could make enough of a difference that it's worth contemplating the importance of trying to stop some of that ongoing damage. Because as much as we aspire to a future Democratic progressive president and a Democratic Congress doing a really progressive trade agreement, we don't know what the future will hold politically. We don't know what the future will hold policy-wise. And if we have in front of us the chance to try and stop some of NAFTA's damage in a real way, then for me, I mean, I largely leave the politics to other people. The policy sort of moral imperative is you can either have the old NAFTA or you can have something that might fix the damage. When you get to the standard of you have something that might fix some of that damage, slow it down, then for me, the choice is you go for the fix, particularly with ISDS, because you're signaling to the whole world
right.
that okay. they have the power to join, to take the U.S. cover, to join the exit of this corporate power scheme.
Okay.
But, you know, people with smarter political judgment.
Well, no, I understand. That's why I wanted you on. I wanted to get an assessment of just like, you know, how dramatic of an improvement would this be to warrant potentially Donald Trump being able to go through the three states that he won by, you know, less votes than show up at a really big rally or pretty close. With a picture of Richard Trumka and saying to people in these states where you do have a much higher density of union workers, probably somewhere around 25% of households, saying, look, I came through for you guys. And that, I mean, that's ultimately the question is something like this, when you're talking about a marginal, such a thin, razor thin, a chance of Donald Trump winning, or I should say winning by a razor thin margin, is it ultimately worth this? Well, in terms of timing, is there any type of clock ticking?
A clock ticking on the agreement?
No, a clock ticking on the renegotiated agreement. In other words, when Donald Trump signed it a year ago as a way of saying, like, okay, now we're going to go work it out, was there, this expires in 12 months, this expires in 24 months, if we don't get it done within 36 months, is there any type of clock ticking? In other words, could these negotiations have gone on for another 5-10 months?
I think that, no, there is no legal clock ticking is the answer. And I think that the, again, I leave the politics to other people,
right.
but I think that from some of the people I have heard talk about this, who I think are very smart politically, a lot of people thought politically it was a smarter move to have a vote on a revised NAFTA in the lame duck session after the 2020 election, so that Trump could not go around the country announcing he had achieved this. Now, on the other hand, I do want to say that he can run around saying he's renegotiated NAFTA, but the reality is we're losing manufacturing jobs. We're basically slipping into a recession in the manufacturing sector. So currently, there is an increase in layoffs in the manufacturing sector such that you can say, you know, I've been a great success. He can claim that, you know, he's fixed things. But if people's actual experiences, they have been laid off from manufacturing jobs, if the Democratic candidate's running around saying there are X hundred thousands of less manufacturing jobs,
here's how much bigger the trade deficit is than it was at the start of the Trump administration. Here are all the things the president didn't deliver on trade.
Right.
I don't know how to judge what the impact of this agreement is.
Right. I mean, we have farmers who are being who have taken it, gotten smashed in the face by the Trump administration. There is no reason to believe that they're not supporting Trump as much as they were. My concern really is more the imagery. We live in an era now where, if we were going to rely simply on economic news and apply a standard formula to that, then Donald Trump will walk away with this election. And we're living in a different era now. And I guess let me ask you this: when it goes to the Senate, and certainly there has been some pushback by some of the Republicans in the Senate. My understanding is that Mitch McConnell is now planning to bring it up after the impeachment trial, presuming the articles of impeachment go to the Senate at the beginning of the year. So this is going to show up on the calendar in the Senate. Could be February, could be March, could be April, somewhere around there. Senate could easily just say, oh, we're going to pass our version of it, which is going to have that ISDS in it, right? And then they send it back to the House. Is that correct?
It can't happen that way because the way it works is the international agreement itself is signed between the three parties, and that's what determines whether there is, for instance, ISDS or the pharma giveaways. It's the actual agreement. What Congress votes on is what's called implementing legislation, and it basically, the first article says, the United States Congress approves and enters into the international agreement called blah, blah, signed on blah, blah date. And so Congress's authority is only to implement or not implement the actual agreement. The agreement sets the terms. So yesterday, when the amendments to the agreement were signed, that's what's on offer.
So the amendments of the agreement who did the signing yesterday?
The governments of the United States, Mexico, and Canada.
Okay, so the agreement itself now has eliminated the ISDS. So there's no way for the Senate to amend what the House has done. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's not that the House has done it. The actual international agreement signed between the three sovereign nations has in its terms, for instance, what used to be Chapter 11B of the NAFTA, that's Investor State Dispute Settlement, no longer is in the text.
Okay.
And instead, there is nothing between the U.S. and Canada, and there's a special annex with this new limited system with Mexico. And that is that was already in the 2018 text. Yesterday, they then signed pages of amendments to the 2018 text, which got rid of the pharma giveaways, et cetera.
So once those are signed, then the House turns around and says, okay, now we feel comfortable in essentially giving the green light for implementation of this.
That's the way it works. Congress has constitutional authorities to implement the agreements. The executive branch negotiates and enters into them.
When it goes to the Senate, it's an up or down vote.
It's an up or down vote in the Senate. Exactly. Now, the Senate could do there are all kinds of procedural anomalies that would be required, but the Senate could refuse to pick up the bill unless and until XYZ happened. But then they'd have to go back and negotiate some more.
Okay, so Mitch McConnell has an up or down vote essentially for all intents and purposes, and it doesn't go back to the House. I mean that at least alleviates a deep concern of mine, which is that once they've, once the House has gotten sort of pregnant with this idea of like we rolled them and then it comes back to them in a different form, that they wouldn't capitulate. But at least that's off the table. All right. Well, Lori, I appreciate this assessment of it. And so, people can make their own determinations as to whether from a political standpoint, if it's worth it. And it may be one of those things where, I'll tell you on November, whatever it is, 8th, 2020.
Oi.
Exactly. Well, Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, really appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
I
I would like to have every interview I do end with the guest saying, "Oi." I think that's probably apropos for this era. Two clips I want to play before we go. The first, or I should say the second, is going to be one of the questions that Dianne Feinstein asked of Michael Horowitz. Horowitz is the Inspector General on the Inspector General of the Department of Justice. And he was testifying in front of the Senate today as to the investigation that he did into the launching of the counterintelligence investigation against the Trump administration. It looks like we're having all sorts of problems with that that video. We're trying to line up the second video, and I'm trying to vamp in between. And that hearing, I think, is just maybe they just took a break, and I don't know if it's going to wrap up for the day. But essentially, what's at stake here is the ability for the Republicans to maintain this deep state fiction that has been ongoing. I mean, I don't know. How long has QAnon been putting this out there? And really, Bill Barr has been pushing quite a bit of it. So we will get to that. In fact, should we play that first? Can you? Yeah, we'll play this first. So this is Michael Horowitz. And remember, the name of the investigation that first, the counterintelligence investigation that was launched into the Trump campaign was spurred by George Papadopoulos saying to what we believe is an Australian former diplomat. In fact, I think he was even more than just a diplomat. I think he was actually like a fairly high-placed, functionally equivalent of the State Department from Australia. I met in a bar, and Papadopoulos says, you know, we're getting information from the Russians that is going to help the campaign. And and that's basically when this thing started. And again, obviously, real deficiencies they talk about in the FISA application for I can't even remember his name now. What's that guy's name? The crazy guy, Carter Page. But that was not sort of the focus of this investigation. Carter Page was one element of it, and they have been basically surveilling Carter Page on and off since 2013. So here's Dianne Feinstein asking Michael Horowitz the question of, this is specifically about the parallel investigation that's going on with Bill Barr and the U.S. attorney from Connecticut, Durham. Durham wrote a letter after meeting with Horowitz saying, "I don't agree with all the conclusions." But Horowitz had, prior to that, met with Durham and Barr and said, "Give me any information that you have that you think should change my conclusions in this investigation." Here's that question.
FBI Director Wray provided a written response to your report, accepting all of your findings. And these include the key finding that there was, quote, an authorized purpose and actual factual predication for the investigation. By contrast, Attorney General Barr expressed his doubt about the legitimacy of the FBI's investigation in press statements. Did Attorney General Barr provide any evidence that caused you to alter this key finding that the FBI investigation had an adequate predicate?
No, we stand by our finding.
Thank you. During your investigation, Attorney General Barr stated his belief that, quote, spying on the Trump campaign did occur, end quote. And as you said, your investigation found no evidence that the FBI placed any confidential source within the Trump campaign or tasked any confidential source to report on the
Trump campaign. This holiday season, ask yourself, what do you want?
No evidence that political bias or improper motivations influence the decision to use confidential sources as part of the investigation.
That's correct.
Did your office ask Attorney General Barr and U.S. Attorney John Durham to share whatever evidence they had that might be relevant to your investigation?
We asked Mr. Durham to do that.
And what about Attorney General Barr?
And Attorney General Barr.
Thank you. So nothing they could provide altered your office's conclusion that the FBI did not place spies in the Trump campaign.
No, none of the discussions changed our findings here.
Thank you.
Okay.
In a press statement.
There you go. So there was nothing that Barr or Durham had as of a week or two ago that countervails this their findings. So apparently Barr and Durham are withholding information from the inspector general, or they're hoping to find other information that would justify their statements that they released saying that there's something wrong with this investigation. I mean, a Bill Barr is on basically, you know, some type of writer's retreat right now, where he and Durham are held up in some type of, you know, I don't know, some cabin somewhere, just bouncing ideas off each other, trying to come up with a good story. So we shall see. All right, we don't have that other video. That's okay. That's okay. Don't worry about it. We don't need it. All right, we're going to take a break. Oh, first, let me just read this, too, just because it's a correction. And we had somebody on hold yesterday for a long time. I don't know. This is a comment that she wanted to make. She was on hold from hi, Sam. I'm a union rep for the BECTU union at the BBC. The BBC is not state media in any way. It's a public broadcaster. The funding comes from a television license. That is, if you buy a television, you have to pay a yearly license fee, which goes directly to the BBC. The funding never touches the government. This is a similar setup to like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. There is no appropriation from Congress. There is just a funding mechanism where they get fees from banks. That's my addition. She writes, the one minor exception to that is the Foreign Office contributing to the Foreign Language Services of the World Service broadcasts in other countries. And then she says, the BBC often ends up in fights with the government of the day, et cetera, et cetera. Our public charter mandates impartiality. We do take that very seriously. I started on the BBC news help desk and talking to journos every day, so they also take that seriously, and most refuse to even vote because of it. Laura Quisenberg has been running all over the country covering the election, and trusted source sent her and Peston, that's another, I guess, reporter, the video. Well, Michael, tell us what the video is.
It was a video that apparently the Tories were sort of spreading fake news about being attacked, I think at a hospital, some type of anti-labor video. And she shared it, and it was debunked, and it was sort of like it was the case of people saying that the BBC was sharing fake news. That's what she's referring to.
And so
and she's saying that instead of, you know, it wasn't malicious, she was harried and, you know, over busy covering the election.
She said, yes, she goes on to say, Laura apologized for the mistake. A couple of newspaper columnists said it was BBC publishing fake news, when in reality, it was a very busy woman. Should have checked more carefully. Maxim I try to live by is don't attribute to malice what can generally be explained by ignorance. There is sometimes, in my experience, ignorance being influenced by malice. They're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah, there's.
I have a few responses to this, with all due respect.
And she goes on to say, I'm not defending the BBC because I work there. I work there because I defend it. I just spent £100 or so on hold on international rates just trying to say all this. And I hope you're feeling a bit better today. Left is best. The only thing I would say is, for sure, use Skype. Use Skype.
Yeah, please use Skype. I take the point about calling. I mean, Yes, it's. I think a lot of people do call BBC state media. I think I've gotten into the habit because I actually do think of the BBC World Service. But fair enough, I take that point. But I mean, there's been multiple examples, including of this same person, Laura Kunzenberg, sort of. I mean, even just tweeting, and this might sound sort of not particularly serious, but it really is in the context of the election, sort of drawing an equivalency between Boris Johnson lying about checkpoints at the Northern Irish border in his Brexit deal, potentially, with Jeremy Corbyn pretending to watch the Queen's Christmas speech. That's one thing that people really got upset at her about. There's at least two different instances, and we don't know why, where video has been edited. I mean, we played one on this show where an audience member asked Boris Johnson about honesty, and he says, well, I think that's really important. They all laugh at him. And then in the rerun package on BBC, the laughing is edited out. So, you know, I mean, it's weird. It's tough when people send, you know, messages like this, because I've had the same dynamic with people around NPR as an example. I have no doubt that there's plenty of people who work at NPR and the BBC who do great. I mean, I use the BBC, but I mean, I'm sorry. There is a massive media bias against Corbyn, and it is partially reflected in the BBC.
It's also problematic if you have a trusted source that has burned you. You should be burning that source.
Well, I mean, it's a question of a speed reaction, which, you know, by the way, like, I mean, we're all susceptible to, and I think a lot of people including I'm sure myself, have made mistakes like that. But you're still going to get, you know, you're still going to get slapped on the wrist by that, particularly when there is a broader. I mean, they've chosen to cover the anti-Semitism scandal in a certain way, which is not, you know. Look, it's not, of course, they're not going to cover it the way the Tribune or I would cover it, but a objective one would certainly look at the Tory party problems, the alt-right stuff much more seriously. It would, you know, it would be a little bit credulous. I mean, I'm sorry. BBC is absolutely biased against Labour, and I don't know where.
But the bottom line is that we can say is it's not state media.
It's fair enough. We can call it is a public broadcaster.
Here's like I say.
Of course, in my politics, state media does not necessarily mean a negative thing.
Right. But it's just about accuracy. You know, here we would say, you know, stupid or evil is the way that we would say the malice versus ignorance, because we're American and we don't use such big words as malice or ignorance. But like I say, in my experience, stupid people can be evil. And even if you're stupid and you can either be evil and a little stupid or stupid and a little evil. And that ends up severely hampering, you know, what you project onto TV. In some ways, it's, you know, I don't know which is worse, but you can be both. And you can and ignorant, just ignorant enough to trust, you know, the wrong sources, or I should say, ignorant enough that your evil sources can fool you. Like you really do have to look at the sort of the results. But I do I do appreciate at the very least the clarification on the nature of the funding for the BBC, because that also opens up, like, it seems to me, why can't we have, we already do this with cable, right? I mean, that's what cable access things are. We could actually create something like that, put another fee on. We will get to that. All right, in the meantime, it's not going to work? All right, don't worry about it. Let's just pass then. Yes or no? Okay.
You can still see the body language between you guys.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to play that clip of, you know, where Barbara Boxer was. We were talking about the USMCA. We'll, maybe we'll do that later, but I don't think so. I think that's done. All right. We're going to take a quick break here. But first, let me just remind you, this episode brought to you by Blinkist. The Blinkist app takes the key takeaways from thousands of best-selling nonfiction books, condenses them down just to 15 minutes, either in a reading format or a listening format. 10 million people are using Blinkist right now. It has a massive and growing library from self-help to business to health and history books. Right now, you can get 25% off your first year at Blinkist.com/majority. Also, a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the show commercial-free, and you get extra content virtually every single day, and you're supporting the show. All of those, it's a threefer, as we say. And also, sign up for the AM Quickie at amquickie.com. You can listen to both the shows on the app, which you can get for free at majorityapp.com. Kyle has been going crazy, updating, perfecting the app. I think we're there now. The iOS version and the Android version, check it out. It's a great way to listen to the show live, listen to it. You can IM the show. You can call the show. You can listen to the AM Quickie, all of it. It's all there for your listening and watching pleasure. And lastly, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Check out the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Check out the Majority Report blend. Last night was Tuesday night. Michael, you're hungover. What happened?
If only it were so. It would be simple to solve the problem. Last night, Camila Escalante joined us. Telesaur, we talked about elections in Dominica, the Caribbean community, and Venezuela, and fighting imperial interference from the U.S. across the Caribbean and Latin American region. Chris Nineham talked about the UK elections in the context of the British state, how it actually works, the sort of institutional context of British politics. We talked about the danger of climate catastrophe turning into eco-authoritarianism, with examples from Australia to Germany to the United States. And in the postgame, we talked about what is the European centrist view in the age of populism, talking about the career of former German foreign minister Joschka Fischer. We did the definitive debunk of Hillary Clinton on Howard Stern and a whole bunch more. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Grab your tickets February 7th, the Bell House with incredible guests. Link in the blog description.
Got another correction. I think you'll find that we did the definitive debunk on Hillary Clinton on Howard Stern earlier in the day.
Oh, I thought you meant the one that I did last Thursday on this show.
I didn't see that one.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I wasn't paying attention to yours. So similarly, couldn't comment.
So you did it again.
I did the more thorough one.
Matt!
Without the Clinton sympathy.
Yeah, folks. Literary Hangover. Most recently, we did The Crucible, that play by Arthur Miller you might have read in high school or middle school. We talk about the House and American Activities Committee background and how Arthur Miller was sort of used by both sides, or attempted to use by both sides, in the Cold War, and how he tried to stay neutral. And so check it out, folks.
All right, folks, don't forget you can hear the Antifada at patreon.com/theAntifada. Quick break, fun half. See you there.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
Dude.
You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.